I'm Fathery.
This is Dave.
And this is Text Trek.
Engage.
Welcome to the 28th installment of the Text Trek podcast, where we will be talking about Star Trek Discovery Episode 8, Si Vis Pacem Parabellum, I think, which is the Latin for...
Who's going to correct you? Some Roman emperor?
Well, maybe.
Some Latin teacher? That's all they got?
It's not a quite dead link. Actually, if you go to Starfleet Academy, you learn Latin, because when Wesley came back to the Enterprise, him and Picard were talking Latin to each other.
Were they?
Yeah.
I took Latin in high school. I got no room to actually criticize.
That's lame. Why didn't you take Spanish? You live in Texas.
I was an introvert, and I didn't want to have something where I had to speak it aloud all the time, and I thought since it was a dead language, I wouldn't have to. As it turns out, we still had to sometimes.
But the translation is, if you want peace, then get ready to fuck people up in war, or something
like that. I see Bella is in there, and it's like the root for bellicose, I'm sure, and all that stuff.
But it's an unusual title, because as I'm sure we'll delve into, it doesn't really seem to match the story we were told tonight.
It's interesting, although of course this story is in some ways, as you noted earlier, is something of a setup for another episode.
Yeah.
It does stand on its own, a clear arc of events occurred, and there was a definite, pretty important subplot, a few subplots I should say. Stamets had a subplot. And notably, was it Admiral
Cornwell?
Cornwell also had a subplot that was maybe more. Well, I don't know. They were both pretty important, actually.
Yeah. So this episode seems like its main job was to set up the fall finale that we'll be talking about next week. That I'm guessing will be a pretty big deal to keep people enticed and ready to come back in January to see what happens next.
Yeah.
But just to get into the story of this week's episode, just a real quick recap. We start things off with actually seeing the Disco in combat, which we've mentioned how we don't really see a lot of that in the show. But
yeah,
we see the USS Discovery jump into a battle that's in progress, where we have the USS Gagarin, named after a famous cosmonaut, Yuri Gagarin, the first man to go into outer space.
To orbit the Earth, is that basically
it?
Yeah,
he did like one orbit.
Yep.
And this ship is under attack by Klingons. We see that more and more Klingon ships are using the cloaking technology. Discovery is unable to save these guys. Their ship is destroyed, so Lorca is frustrated about that. We see that Lieutenant Stamets has reverted back to his asshole stage. He's no longer the mellow hippie guy.
Yeah, it's an interestingly weird thing. I presuming there is some mirror universe thing going on, it does seem clear that he's experiencing like a time jump, maybe.
Yeah, when he calls her captain, I'm wondering if he's like seeing things from the future. We know that is her aspiration, is to be captain someday.
That does notch the show just one step closer to crazy theory of time, that they will become a time traveling ship as a permanent thing.
But it's
crazy.
We have our main story is Burnham, Tyler, and Saru are on a planet that looks like a forest in Canada, but it's actually an alien planet where everything has a weird vibration. And
Canadian forests don't have blue trees. What are you even talking about?
It looks like a Canadian forest that someone had done like some digital color manipulation.
It's honestly a simple effect that I think usually works pretty well.
But the idea of this planet is that, like, the rocks, the grass, the dirt, the trees, everything has, like, a weird vibration to it, and there's this giant crystal tower that formed on the planet that is transmitting this sound wave thing, I guess, even though sound doesn't travel through space.
Yeah, but it's like the frequency is being conducted through the crystalline transmitter, yeah. So that that vibration, it does go out.
The idea is to try to figure out if they can use this planet to... I guess it's kind of like a sonar type. It would be able to detect the Klingon cloaked ships.
Right. It's like almost like they want to ping the tower, yeah. And they want to know where the Klingon ships are. They don't get into a lot of gobbledygook on this show. It was not... So it was explained using the sonar metaphor. They just very quickly threw that out there as a notion. But the important thing is they can... This is a little bit like how Galactica tended to handle their sort of science fiction-y ideas. They explained it quick and dirty terms.
And we learned that the planet is not uninhabited, that there are glowy, blue, non-corporeal aliens there.
It's about as classic Trek or series
very
as you get.
Traditional trope. Every TV show had at least one non-corporeal species show up.
What we evolve into after we get big heads sometime a few centuries out from now, and if you go forward a few eons, energy.
And then Saru goes from hating the planet because he's sensitive to these sound waves that only he can hear, but he has a kind of a weird out-of-body experience with the blue alien glowy light creatures. They seem to be like taking him on some type of weird acid trip of self-reflection where he learns not to live in constant fear. For the first time in his life, he feels peace. These aliens, their goal is for everything to vibrate on the same frequency, if you will, to be harmonized.
Right. It's like he landed in California, like a California crystal shop, and they actually had some abilities rather than charlatanism.
Yes. And they open his mind to this idea of, like, we can all just live on this planet and hold hands and sing Kumbaya,
Although that manifests for him in a somewhat more violent way, that ultimately, in another very classic Trek trope, results in him in hand-to-hand combat with his superior strength, which I didn't know he had.
Yeah.
He's got what I would say is, honestly, the kind of, in Star Trek terms, Vulcan-level strength, Romulan-level strength. He's... real strong, but not quite into superhero territory, but damn strong.
Yeah, the...
communicator crushing strong.
The prey becomes the predator.
Oh, yes.
As he's kind of out of his mind, he's thinking that, yeah, I gotta stop Burnham and Tyler from contacting the ship, because I don't want them to leave, I want us all just to live here and live in peace. But... we again have Michael Burnham doing some cleverness when she actually, not only does she get the communication through the crystal tower, mm-hmm. but then she also like tries to explain to the aliens, like, you need to help us end this war.
Right. And she pitches the case.
Yeah.
She makes the case for the Federation.
Yeah. So we see her in a first contact situation. But the aliens get this different idea. Instead of helping them find cloaked ships, they actually send a message out to the Klingons and invite Cole, who is the big asshole, the main bad guy of the show.
Yes.
And they invite him to come have like a peace talk. We know from a couple episodes ago how well those peace talks on alien planets go with these Discovery-style Klingons. Mm-hmm. And speaking of Klingons, we also see Laurel again, and we see Admiral Cornwell again. Mm-hmm. And we're not quite sure if Admiral Cornwell is alive or dead.
Yep, there was a faked interrogation. Some questions about motives on Laurel's part, whether what exactly she's trying to what she was trying to manipulate on the chessboard. But I am quite sure that story is not done yet.
Yeah, and I think that's something that we'll see the payoff to next week. So again, this episode is just like a big setup for the fall finale. So
I feel like I have to defend the show a little bit on the basis of it being just a setup episode. I also don't like Like, to me, if you told me that an episode is just a setup for another episode, I'd say it failed. I'd be annoyed at it. Now, yes, it does progress it to there, but it did have a functioning story within it and subplots and things that were achieved. You know, it revealed, had big reveals about Saru. It, progressed things a bit for Ash and, I can't burn them. Mm. And it did show them sort of, you know, navigating a, sort of awkward first contact. So I hate to think of it as just a setup. That sounds to me that's lame.
But I think that was like the primary thing the episode was doing.
I mean, I guess so. I will say, you know, it was the first episode in several episodes where I felt it was a slight downturn from what I had been enjoying in the previous episodes. The last three or so, I felt like I've been really strong episodes, and this one dipped a little bit.
Yeah, every week I've always said, well, this week's episode is my favorite one so far.
Mm-hmm.
You know, going into the night, my rankings of the Discovery episodes would be episode 7 first, then 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, all the way down.
Right.
But with this episode, I don't like it as much as the last two, probably. I would put Lethe and Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad above this one. I do like that it still feels more tonally consistent than the earlier episodes felt, and the idea that these last few episodes the show is kind of
they've for sure hit at the very least an equilibrium.
Yes,
Burnham is on the show, that is to say she's an established member of the crew. She's working with them. We're past her first contact essentially with them as an alien species, so she's accepted. We know that Lorca's duplicitous and dangerous. We don't know. We haven't kind of maybe assessed exactly how bad, but for sure he's something of an antagonist on the show. But the crew is now meshing regularly, and so they have an equilibrium that they, you know, there's a something of a status quo maybe for the first time in these last few episodes.
And what you've talked about is that the first few episodes you kind of felt like the ethos was off from.
Sure.
What you wanted Star Trek to be. And I do, like, within the
it
last...
It wasn't just... I mean, well, weirdly, part of that is that Star Trek kind of has a tendency to be something of a kind of a sci-fi comfort food. And you know, they solve their problems in an hour, or at least they do their best. They don't always do it, but they often do. And so that for sure was missing, but also just that kind of camaraderie and all of the other things you expect from a crew of, you know, usually something of the best. Even if there's, like, Maquis on them, like in Voyager, they still all prove to be top-notch in their jobs. So I felt like, at the very least, it's gelling. It's fulfilling several of Star Trek's previous things, even though it's for sure subverting them in ways as well. And has their long arc story and stuff going on.
But I would say if you have any friends that maybe gave up on the show early, because they thought the first... two or three episodes felt too non-Star Trek-ish. I would definitely encourage you to let them know that they should check out some of the newer Discovery episodes, because it does seem to kind of approach that
messaging
ethos.
Something exactly to that effect with a friend the other day when I was talking about this, and he was like, you know, I actually don't know how much he had watched, but he said, you know, watched a few or something like that. He's like, it didn't impress me enough to get CBS All Access. And I said, like, you know, I might have been in that same spot were I not doing a podcast, but actually I probably would have still wanted to check it out at least for at least half the season, I would imagine. But anyway, but I was like, yeah, I'm picky, and sometimes I can be mercurial. And I was like, man, episode 3, 4, 5, somewhere right around in there, much faster than classic. That is historically Trek speed gets its sea legs.
Yeah.
So I was like, man, you know, give a few more episodes a shot.
Yeah. For most Star Trek shows, we're now already in like season 3 level quality.
Right.
But just this episode specifically, I guess the main story would be what happened on the planet Pavo with Saru specifically. So, what were your thoughts on that aspect of the episode?
Actually, I'm gonna rewind just slightly. I'm gonna throw out a complaint first. I felt like this episode I got off on the wrong foot with it because of that Klingon battle a little bit.
Why? I liked it.
It was okay, but I felt like there, you know how I mentioned one of the things I wanted to see was like extended battles, but I kind of wanted to see a little bit deeper tactics. And this was still the, can we get, but you know, can we block their shot with our ship? You know, it's like, it does make the battle sequence very clear, but I like felt like they were still just flying around and just pew pew, you know, like I wanted to see a little bit more. Hey, try and box them in. Hey, try and flank them, or they're flanking us.
They were doing the normal Star Trek stuff, though, where you're like, yeah, use attack pattern Omega Beta yeah. 3 and stuff
I'm just
like
saying,
that.
When you're in a wartime show, it's one of the things that I might have liked, at least, not that I want it to be that all the time, but I kind of want to see, you know, what is it that Lorca does aside from just having a cool ship that makes him an effective military guy?
Yeah.
Now, that said, it was probably also... Those Klingon, I was always hoping to see some Klingon ships that look more traditional, and they seem to have been to have redesigned the Klingon fleet just as assuredly as they redesigned their faces.
Yeah,
It's like the D7 is gone.
It'll show up though. I think eventually.
Man, I don't know.
The battle sequence of this episode, I think that was just to show us that the Klingon cloaking devices are. Kind of their answer to the Federation having the ship that can pop up anywhere.
Right.
Well, the Klingons are starting to like mass produce their cloaking technology. Yep. More and more ships are using that.
I suppose that maybe bugged me a little bit too. I'm not a person who like is upset that the show is showing technology that we didn't see hereafter, because clearly the battle isn't done yet, and likely some of this technology will be lost, or all the technology will be lost. But, you know, the first time they encounter a Romulan with its cloaked in TOS... Are they like, when they like, oh, this is just like 10 years ago when the Klingons all had cloaks for a while?
Well, Enterprise already messed that up, because on Enterprise they had Romulans who could cloak.
Yeah. It's the danger, I guess, of writing, you know, prequel stuff and really wanting to get to what you think of as a core element of like an alien race or something like that. And this, you're like, it's hard to resist, I guess, that, you know, using that. Now, that said, its use on the show is just fine. It makes sense to have it as a counterpoint. You know, they both have their big tech. Discovery can get anywhere, but it's just one ship. Klingons have cloaks, and a lot of ships can use it. So, you know, like I actually think the battle served a good dramatic purpose as far as, like, what it did in the story. But the nitpicky Trek guy in me, and you know I'm not usually that nitpicky, but it did bug me a little bit. That said, it did look cool as shit. Like, their special effects are always good. I wish their Klingon ships weren't so bulky and kind of, like, not organic looking, but whatever it is that
They have so many different Klingon designs, because, like, they want that idea of, like, every house has its own looking ship.
Right.
Yeah, that's why I think, like, eventually when we have, like, a unified empire,
Putting out some D7s.
Yeah, we'll have, like, the normal, the Klingon Imperial Defense Force Navy that has normal Matt Jeffries design.
Do you think, here's the scene I want to see. I want to see Cole, isn't it?
Yeah.
I want to see him saying, like, you know, like, looking at the design for the D7, he's like, oh, this looks good, but could you add about 1,000 coffins on the outside? They're going to be like, it's not cost effective, you know, could we just leave that part off? And he'll reluctantly give in. Now, the episode got off on a slightly bad foot with me for that. I'm always like kind of like seeing them get out a little bit outside of their zone and like do planetary stuff.
Yeah,
I remember reading, you know, or I've heard actors I think usually tend to like that because it gets them off of the sets and into kind of more interesting environments. You know, they just get some fresh air.
I was watching After Trek and they were really complaining about shooting this.
Really?
Because, yeah, they said it was like really hot and there were so many mosquitoes that producer...
Where did they film it?
I'm sure somewhere in Canada, because they shoot the show in Toronto.
Right.
So I'm sure it was somewhere around that area on the other side of one of our Great Lakes.
Yep.
But they said that, like, there were so many mosquitoes that, like, you would breathe them in.
Yeah. I wonder how they managed to avoid that in their photography. I didn't notice it at all.
Maybe they have some digital mosquito removal.
Yeah, somebody's cleaning that up. I especially feel for, is it Doug Jones?
Yeah.
As Saru, because man, under all that makeup and stuff like that, you can't, I'm sure, easily do the, get off my face mosquito.
And they said that when he took his alien hand gloves off, it was just like gallons of sweat poured out.
I believe it.
So when we did finally get to the, off, away from the battle that you didn't like.
Right.
Which was only there just to remind us of the cloaking devices and why they need a way to detect cloaking devices.
Right.
And when we get on the planet with...
It also showed, we had heard earlier that they were almost like, they were kind of taking the lead in the war, and this made clear that the balance of power is maybe shifting back a little bit.
Yeah.
Because Lorca was not able to save a guy, which, mentally, that's a pretty big thing for him, to see another ship get blasted, taken out from under him. So, but continue.
No, so what did you think about the story on the planet Pavo?
A little bit dry. There's something about those glowy aliens that I've seen them used effectively at times, but usually they kind of appear. Usually, when they appear to say "Charlie X, stop making your trouble," or when you've got a childlike alien that they're yelling at. Or I suppose when they're Q or something like that, that's got some deep character. This was just a kind of a weird light. I was interested by the kind of moral conundrum that they had, where they had something that they needed to do to that could have like really turned the tide of the war, and then they had a first contact scenario, which I guess like is according to Starfleet or rules, that always takes precedence, right? First contact.
Mm-hmm.
And so that they had to choose between those two things. That was an interesting dilemma to me, but, they kind of get... Once the first contact thing is going, they're kind of running with it. And what was the deal? Why was Discovery not in, like, constant communication with them? Oh, it was because of the actual signals themselves were too disruptive or something?
Well, I think it was that...
Had to park a ways off from it and hike.
Yeah, they couldn't beam down exactly to that crystal tower.
Right. I thought it was interesting enough, though. It's, it is a little, hippy-dippy kind of the harmonic crystal guys. But what they did was interesting, which is to, essentially possess Saru or, mess with his head, remove some blocks that he had so that... the point later in the episode where he says that he was able to experience a moment without fear for the first time is pretty dramatic, and I think Doug Jones did some excellent acting there. I did kind of enjoy seeing an old school Trek fight between them, but I was not painful. Super...
It looks painful to get kicked in the chest by that Saru hoof.
I felt like ribs might have gotten bruised or broken in that, because I was like,
she had that cool black vest on that they wear.
They
beam over. They're
away team vest. Yeah. It looked. I actually kind of liked that. Unlike the usual, just kind of get a little bit dirtied up in a fist fight on TOS or even TNG. This one, I almost got the impression that he might have broken a rib or two with that kick. He's also always super fast, apparently. Dude can, like, book it.
Yeah, that was kind of cool to see him running like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder, with him being the prey species, are they like...
What are the predators like?
Is he like a... Like, supposed to be in, like, a herd of buffalo that are, like, running from wolves or something?
Yeah, if they have technology, as they presumably do to have gained admittance to the Federation...
We don't know if his planet is a Federation member world.
I guess so. Like, you think he might have just been like, but they generally shouldn't. They don't reveal themselves to people who don't have at least warp technology. So unless there was kind of an odd, it could have been an odd series of circumstances got him in there, but one would presume that they have.
Yeah. My thing with this episode and with the story on the planet specifically. Is that I was kind of disappointed,
mm-hmm.
and a big part of that is just because the writers had kind of hyped up this episode. Before the show even premiered, I remember Kristen Beyer, who wrote this episode, she said something about, like, episode 8 is going to be, like, this really cool Saru episode.
Oh.
Where you'll really get to... I mean, this was before the show had aired, so it was like, if you're wondering about this alien character that Doug Jones is playing, just wait for episode 8. And so this whole time, like, that's been in the back of my head. And I was kind of expecting...
I remember you mentioning that, but I'd forgotten it while I was watching it.
And I thought we would get, like, a look at his planet or, like, some, you know, explanations about his backstory and why he chose to join Starfleet. Because they've said that he's the only Kelpian in Starfleet.
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of makes me think they might not be a member world. It might that's be a possible. Situation like Worf. Or even Nog on Deep Space Nine.
Right.
Where their planet is not part of the Federation, but they still want to join Starfleet.
Right. But yeah, that may have just been a case of overhype. I don't think I felt that particular weight or I wasn't disappointed that there wasn't more of them because I had forgotten that expectation. Mm-hmm. I knew that there was, like, supposed to be a Saru-centric episode, and this did zero in on him a bit, but, there was things, like, we learned more about his physical capabilities. Let's just quick go through. We learned more about his physical capabilities.
Because we never knew he was strong before, like, crushing communicators.
Yeah,
like
again, that must mean the Predators are pretty bad.
Like when Khan crushed the phaser pistol in front of Kirk in Space Seed.
Yep. That is the default level of, if you're super strong in Star Trek... You are exactly like phaser crushing, Spock view screen crushing. Yeah.
And iMud, one of the androids, crushed a communicator.
Yep. I want to be that strong one day. I don't need to be Superman level strength. I just need to be communicator
crushing. Spider-Man level?
Yeah. Maybe kind of lift a car with some work.
Who would win in a fight between Spider-Man and Khan?
Spider-Man. Khan's not that strong. Khan's like way weaker.
Oh, the Benedict Cumberbatch Khan could jump really high.
That's true. Like how Spider-Man Khan is jumping over you. that took a weird turn.
Yeah.
Let's see. So we learned more about his physical capabilities. We learned that he lives in some version of omnipresent fear, which sounds terrible. And he makes it sound terrible. Did we learn much beyond that? It does seem like we know he's built up a lot of resentment against Burnham.
Yeah.
And that's why
I loved that exchange where he says they just stop taking things from me.
I love
their chemistry and their backstory.
Such an unusual relationship. If that initial thing about them being brother and sister does that assessment or that I think the actress maybe both of them I can't say her name, Green Sonequa Martin-Green. I think she and Doug Jones may have both mentioned the brother-sister relationship, but it's like a difficult relationship.
Yeah,
it is not like...
An unhealthy sibling.
Yeah, for sure. One with like strong envy and pretty cutting sarcasm and, attempts to one-up each other and all that.
Yeah.
Which is an unusual relationship in Star Trek and interesting for it.
Yeah, I love it. I like the idea.
And in this episode, he got to, stop hitting yourself, get his payback.
Yeah, I like the backstory of him being like, Mom loved you more and then you got her killed.
Yeah.
Because they both loved and respected Captain Georgiou.
Yeah. She was the person who could keep him in line. But yeah, we didn't learn a ton about him, and so that was, maybe a bit more of a missed opportunity. If we were going to see it poking at his mind, it might have been interesting to see
his home planet.
Yeah, that kind of like, almost if you could have seen when he was talking about living in fear, if they could have shown him like the true kind of like visceral fear of being stalked by, the predators there. Which, by the way, that's why I want to know, if they have technology, can't the prey species just find ways to defend themselves? But that's sort of a bigger question. But they could have shown that and then equated that, shown that fear in his eyes, and then they could have cut to, when they were in battle with the Klingons in the first episode and shown his eyes again, and you would have been like, oh, it's that same fear. And then they could have even just shown some casual scene where he was talking to somebody, something from a previous episode, and zero in on his eyes and like, oh, wow, all those scenes he has some version of fear, and it might have hit home kind of more viscerally.
Yeah. He sounds like a person with anxiety issues, for sure.
yeah, sort of writ large.
Constant life
fear, that is kind of what Star Trek often does with their alien species. They take something that we think of as a very human kind of thing, and they write it a little bit larger for science fiction purposes.
I thought he was kind of being too much of a jerk in this episode. Like, the aliens, I guess, are to blame for his behavior.
Yeah.
But
when he was in sickbay, I was almost thinking they were going to say that he was going to say something like, they didn't take control, like, they just showed me, like, well, and that is kind of what he said. It's like they just showed him a different way of thinking, and then he became, like, a super jerk. But was he a jerk, or was it just, like, the net effect of all that was a natural outpouring of bitterness and anger?
When you crush those people's communicators, and like, you're going to stay on this planet and live in peace, or else I'm going to kick you with my hoof feet if you're not okay with that.
Yeah.
Like, that's definitely, like, you're an asshole if you're doing that.
Right, but like, is it like, if you kind of cut to, like, our inner selves, our the true self that we hide from each other, I could definitely kick you with my hoof feet and wail on you.
I would think you were an asshole, though,
in a heartbeat.
No,
no, no. But he has, like, he has a particular thing that, just like some people kind of feel doubtful of people with anxiety issues, because it's like, if you don't experience it, it's hard to envision it. Saru says he's been living in fear his entire life, and it's hard for us to envision that, maybe. But that's the same sort of fear that someone living in a war-torn third-world country might be, that indoctrinates, gets them, indoctrinated with terrorists and things. You lash out, you look for scapegoats. And if you think about the notion of having that removed in there, well, I guess, that moment's peace might be so important to him that, all the repression kind of, resolves itself in this violent way. I can believe it, at least on a psychological level. As far as, like, wow, that was pretty intense for Saru to do that, yeah, it was kind of shocking. But I sort of believe it psychologically. Like, if you really did live every moment of your several decades of life, I guess, like that, and then you had an opportunity to clear the slate, and the person who's always been an asshole to you was, like, one of the people standing in your way, all that bitterness and fear might kind of channel out in this violent way.
Yeah, but
hoof style.
I get what you're saying, mm-hmm. But for me personally, I would have felt better about the episode if at that end scene in sickbay, if they just explain, like, his brain chemistry was severely altered, like, he can't be held responsible for his actions, uh-huh. And he's even like, oh my god, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that, I wasn't myself.
But they
don't do that.
The show, I'm glad they didn't do that, honestly. I kind of like, it seems typical to me of Discovery that they want to somewhat subvert Trek expectations.
Yeah. Do whatever is the most dramatic.
Right. And having him have this as a true difficulty, something that he may have, like, really taken only, not just a little bit to push him to this edge, because removing, that fear from him is a pretty potent thing. That's not some minor thing. It did seem like he didn't struggle with it quite, though. I guess that is true. We didn't sort of see him struggle with it. It felt more mind control-y, where he was suddenly, like, just telling lies very easily. I talked to the captain. He said this is okay. All that stuff. Should have indicated a little bit more, or maybe talked about it. And this is sometimes something I wish about other things on Discovery, is, if you had seen the doctor talking to Burnham a little bit and saying, asking exactly what went on down there. He doesn't seem to want to talk about it, but, you broke three of your ribs.
And they've always had him be such, like, a by-the-book type guy, where he, like, follows all the Starfleet regulations.
Right.
And
you think he would be more disturbed by his own actions?
Yeah, like he's so... He gives Burnham so much shit, understandably so, about, like, her mutiny.
Right.
And but here we see him, like, this is kind of mutinous, what he's doing on this planet. So.
I wonder if there will be, like, more discussion of it, like, in the episode to follow, since they are so linked, it's possible.
Yeah.
But I think, as a standalone episode, I do think it could have used more of a denouement kind of thing, where they, where that was discussed a little bit more. Whether he, felt it surprising, like, he's scared at how liberated it felt to him, or he has regrets about it, or whatever. I think they could have pushed that conversation a little bit farther.
Yeah, and that very well might be something that's touched on more in the next episode, which we know will take place, you know, pretty much right after this episode ends. So let's just talk about, like, the setup to that and the Klingon story in this episode, mm-hmm. where we have Admiral Cornwell captured by Cole on the sarcophagus ship, mm-hmm. and the Klingon Laurel shows up to interrogate her.
Right.
I liked that exchange between the two of them, where they...
Well, it was interesting. I did not know what Laurel was doing at first. I was as confused as...
The Admiral was,
when she tells her to scream, and I was like, oh, this is, that sounds like sometimes something torturers say right before they do it.
Like Sabretooth and X-Men.
Yes. I don't know if you want to just right jump to what people think of as a bad portrayal of a character, but yes, that's literally were his words. Or scream for me. But we see it's a ruse that's meant to... get the guards thinking, the torture's begun, good times, and then walk away. So that they have a little bit more of time to talk.
Yeah, and this is more of the Klingons in Discovery, are more TOS-style Klingons. Mm. Or what later shows would have as Romulans.
Right, where or Guile.
Yeah, where they're all playing a long game, and they'll do things like ram a cloaked ship into someone else's ship. When they're like, yeah, let's sit down for a peace talk. Or
right.
you capture the admiral who tries to have a peace talk with you. Or you get someone's loyalty by bringing them a bunch of chicken onto their ship.
And, right.
Like, that looked like a chicken leg, what Laurel, like, bit into.
I'm sure it was space chicken, though.
So, yeah, they're definitely, like, a little bit more treacherous and guileful. Mm-hmm. And this idea of, like, I'm not really going to torture you, I'm going to defect over to your side. Which
she said that was kind of shocking. Like, I was like, I did not know. I was definitely torn between, did they just blow my mind by having her really mean that? Or is this, she said that, you know, she could get answers from an interrogation that other people couldn't. Yeah. And I was like, oh, well, this is maybe just her smart-ass plan.
No, I think that she has a plan to not really defect, but that's mm-hmm. going to be part of whatever her and Vok are doing.
Right. What was it she said before that? She asked her how the Federation treats prisoners. I did think it was interesting. She said there's no death penalty.
Yeah.
But of course, we know that Burnham, they made the point in the very episode, has a life sentence.
Yes.
So it's still, they haven't civilized themselves completely.
Another interesting thing about that is we know that this episode takes place in the timeline after the Talos IV incident from the original series failed pilot, The Cage.
Right.
This is after that, and we know that the Starfleet Regulation Order 7, I think, was like, mm-hmm. yeah, the only death penalty still on the books is if you go to Talos 4.
Oh, right.
So, but maybe they hadn't...
That feels a little ridiculous to me, by the way. It's dramatic, but but I don't necessarily take it as, like, as deepest of Trek canon, just because, you know, even though it was spoken in the episode... It seems a little silly.
But that actually wasn't introduced until the later episode of The Menagerie, Part 1,
right.
which would have been after Discovery. So even though the Talos IV became a deal before then, they probably just didn't have that law. If you're going to freak out about the continuity.
The Admiral, she didn't want to throw in an asterisk in her dramatic statement, her defense of humanity. her point was, of course, to say, hey, we're more civilized, we're going to interrogate you in a humane way and then release you. And it was at that point that Laurel said, then I want to defect, right?
Yeah.
Which incidentally, like, traditionally Klingon style, that sounds, I mean, that almost feels cowardly from the Klingon perspective.
It's TOS
to like find out
you're not gonna
get tortured and then be like, oh, thank you, now I want to defect. That's what makes me think it's a ruse.
Yeah.
But I like the idea, though, of a secret Klingon defector. That's a cool notion as well. You got to be pretty removed from the Klingon ethos to want to do that.
And I love that in Laurel's hatred of Cole, she calls him a Patok, which is a Klingon curse word that is apparently a really nasty word that whenever they say it, people are like, oh my god, such language. But
yeah.
we hear that a lot in, like, The Next Generation in Deep Space Nine.
Mm-hmm.
But their plan doesn't go... things don't go according to plan.
It goes awry in a slightly confusing way, actually. Yeah. Like something that I had to ask Fathery about after we had seen it, just because I was like, they were like literally like gonna like just walk to like a shuttle or something like that.
Presumably. Well, they're gonna like set the warp core to explode.
Oh, yeah.
She
yeah.
was like, yeah, I hate Cole having this sacred ship. I want him to die, so I'm gonna blow the ship up.
Yep.
But Cole is, for some reason, just, like, walking around on the ship, and he's like, hey, what are y'all doing?
And then they, like, Lorella's like, I'm fighting her!
Yeah.
But, like, better than that. Like, but it happens in just such a way that I'm like, I wasn't sure at first, did she set up them to be spotted? I wasn't sure if it was convincing or not. It seemed like it could be, like the kind of thing that, like, if you walked in on and then they said, oh yeah, she got loose, she had my phaser, thank God you walked by and distracted her and allowed me to kill her. There was a lot of that sort of ambiguity in there that I think was intentional. I think we're not supposed to quite know every bit of motivation and how it's all going to play out.
Yeah.
Including, we don't know for sure if the Admiral died.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of seems like she died because she's laying unconscious in the room of dead bodies.
She got thrown into, like, some, like, zappy electrical generator, like, little,
she got, like, slammed into a light in the wall.
Yeah.
But
it was a futuristic light that had Ghostbusters electricity. in comic book terms or in, like, a, this is something, or in genre terms, that was not a very definitive death. You didn't see a neck break. You didn't see a blade go through a chest or anything like that. I could easily see that she might have survived it. And certainly things, the way Cole reacts to her. He's like, starts to give her war stripes or whatever, and then he reveals that he saw through her ruse.
Yeah, so I'm not sure why he waited till then to be like, I'm on to your deceptions.
Right. Was it just like, oh yeah, I saw your body language and I could tell you weren't under duress when I passed you in the hallway? But like, the Admiral's body got dropped off, her body I don't know if it was just like the Klingon corpse room or
that's what I got
or what, because there was like a bunch of dead bodies in there and including a bunch of people she knew but did not know were
like,
dead.
Like people who were like loyal to Tecuvma, but they probably died when Cole took over the sarcophagus ship.
Yep. And that definitely seemed to trigger something in her. But I think they cut away before we saw whether she just left the Admiral's body there or did something else. For all we know, she might have been like, hey, wake up, go do this.
Yeah, and this is why I say this episode had a lot of setup for the next week's episode. Because a lot of this stuff, like, it feels like it wasn't that thought out.
Maybe that was one of the reasons why the episode didn't connect that well for me, was because it was sort of a setup episode.
Yeah, they're like, okay, here's the things that we know we're going to do. We have a very clear vision of episode 9, the fall finale. Here are some things we need to put into episode 8 to set all that stuff up. I mean, we need Admiral Cornwell to do this. We need Laurel to do this.
Right.
And
I feel like the next episode is basically going to be a version of Heat, the scene from Heat where Robert De Niro and Al Pacino sit down and talk in a coffee shop and weigh, you know, sort of have their war of words and see if they can find any common ground over the course of like a 10-minute intense conversation. I only glimpsed the trailer because I didn't want to know too much, but at the very least, it does seem like the alien crystal Gaia type aliens. What are they called?
The Pavoans.
Pavoans. At the very least, it does seem like, well, we know from just the end of the episode that Cole's ship, like, or
the sarcophagus
like a
fleet, ship,
yeah, is coming. So at the very least, we know they're going to get some version of their sit down or confrontation.
Or the Klingon ship of the dead is what that Admiral Vulcan called it.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, I like that description, the Klingon ship of the dead.
It's a cool name. That Admiral Vulcan sounded like he took no shit either.
I really don't like a bald Vulcan. It's just something about that seems weird to me.
Yeah, you think, they usually have the kind of close crop haircut, usually that sort of their page boy haircut.
Yeah.
That's the traditional one. You know.
Well, that would look weird on a black actor.
Yeah, but I guess usually they just do short hair.
Yeah, like Tuvok on Voyager. He looked fine with his short hair, so...
You know, it's...
Bald Vulcans are a little weird.
I guess the Vulcans are not completely above ornamentation and style. They do... They do have their leisure clothes and stuff like that, and so...
Well, this guy could be, like, 140, and he just went bald naturally.
Yeah, I was going to say, the male pattern baldness might be a thing on Vulcan, and they're like, well, it would be illogical to interfere with a natural process of the body, but secretly inside they're seething over their baldness, and that's
they're just repressing that.
that's what really is the hardest thing they have to deal with.
But... one thing I am looking forward to next week is if Burnham will come face to face with Cole,
mm-hmm.
because we saw that in way back from the premiere night when they had the season long trailer, and it said later this season,
right.
on Star Trek Discovery. We do see her confronting Cole.
Oh, so, I did not remember that.
Yeah, so I'm wondering if that's going to be in this episode, if they're going to be on the sarcophagus ship.
Certainly seems possible. I'm terrible with the names. The Admiral's name?
Cornwell. That's the one you can't remember.
Yeah. Is it Cornwell or Cornwall?
Cornwell. And this is my mistake. The first few times we talked about her, I was saying Cornwall. I think it was because I always watch everything with the captions on. I think the subtitles had it spelled as Cornwall instead of Cornwell, so that's what threw me off. But... Yeah, it's Cornwell.
The more I've seen of her, I the more I like her, and I think the actress brings some weight to the role every time. I'm hoping she's alive because I've grown to like the character, even though she's just a supporting player.
I like the idea of a psychiatrist who became an admiral in Starfleet,
and she seems to be one of the people who can see through Lorca's bullshit. That means that she's also a liability to him, and in any form that she's, unless they reach some kind of detente through whatever this happens in this episode, even assuming she's alive, it's like he'd have to take her off the chessboard. So it's probably, she's probably either dead or gonna get killed. But if nothing else, I hope we get some more good dramatic scenes out of her. Mm. Because it's interesting to see somebody who was really on equal footing with Lorca, confronting him with his stuff and calling him out.
Yeah, and like I mentioned earlier, this show always seems to make the choice for whatever's the most dramatic. That's what we're going to do.
So. Yeah. Let's see, what else? Anything else notable? There was were there any B-plot stuff that we needed to, or C-plot? Anything going on? Oh, well
The Stamets stuff.
Stamets stuff, yeah. He mistook Tilly for the captain. What I thought about that scene was not like, oh, he's just losing it. It was that it was a time slip. And then when he revealed to her, he did tell her something about things. And how did he describe it? He said, sometimes I feel did he actually say, I'm in one world and sometimes I feel like I'm in another, or was that the gist of it?
Yeah, something along those lines.
Yeah, which, if we see him as some kind of conduit to the Mirror Universe storylines, which we think is gonna very likely happen, that would make sense. Do we think he's literally, in some kind of weird quantum flux, swapping forms with his other self, where they're maybe both almost in the same him at the same time, but one asserts more control?
I think it might be what you said earlier. I think it might be a time shift thing. More than a...
You think he might be future stoned Stamets? do you think though he's a future version of himself?
Well, yeah, because what we saw in the last episode is that he's kind of outside of space time. He wasn't affected by the by Mudd's time shenanigans.
Right.
So I think this might be a more of a temporal anomaly than he's going back and forth between the mirror universe.
Why would it specifically manifest itself in that sort of mellow, chilled out version of himself? That's such an odd way for something like that to manifest.
I think that's also him just how he explained it was I'm just so chill now because I can see the entire universe and I'm high on mushrooms.
Right.
And sometimes with
this it is almost the kind of the cliche of somebody getting high is having that sort of vision where they see the interconnectedness of everything. And he got the ultimate space mushroom.
And sometimes with Discovery I feel like there's kind of too many cooks in the kitchen where you have so many different writers, where you have some of the stuff that Brian Singer had envisioned
Brian
still
Fuller.
I'm sorry, Brian Fuller.
Sorry, I know which one.
And you have, you know, some of that stuff still in there, and then you have like the stuff from Alex Kurtzman, and then, you know, Akiva Goldsman came on and put his stuff in there.
Right.
Then,
it would make sense, especially in the first season, that they might have a little bit of overlapping, you know, different intents for motivation.
You know, you have one guy who's like, yeah, like, so let's do like this cool, like, he's high on mushrooms type thing. And then you have someone else who's like really pushing the, you know, like the quantum jumping thing. So
that's actually, I think I always got the impression that that was sometimes the case on Battlestar Galactica, you know.
And it's also how I felt about Lorca when we were introduced to him.
Right.
Because you have like, okay, he's got like a tribble on his desk. He likes Chinese fortune cookies because his family used to own a fortune cookie factory, I guess.
Yeah, that was a very weird aside.
He's got like the weird eye thing, and it's like all these different things. I felt like it was just so many different writers trying to contribute something to him. That
right. What when they pinned him down as a matter of fact kind of hard ass captain who got shit done, had the weight of a dead crew on his shoulders, would very much go out of his way to try and keep that from happening. But yet at the same time, it seemed like it's only like his crew that he cares about. But they, by and large, I feel like he's more pinned down now than he was in those early episodes. Yeah. So, but I think you might be onto something there where there may be a little bit of overlapping writer intent.
And that's what I've heard, was that in the first five episodes that the writer's room didn't have a really unified,
cohesive
vision of what they were doing. Whereas these episodes coming out now, they do, and maybe that's why like they're getting away from Stamets being the space hippie high on mushrooms.
Right, that was like that was what some minor writer threw in, and that was but we don't have an arc to go with it, so let's just kind of move it out.
Yeah,
yeah, I guess we'll see on that one. It would be interesting if there was a very specific intent, and we get to learn what it is.
But he looks kind of weird, too, when he has, like, the things hooked into his arms. When,
yeah.
He looks like he's, like, Space Jesus.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think that's about it for this episode. Any final thoughts you want to get out there?
You know, I think we covered just about everything in here, unless I'm missing some other little subplot or something in there. Yeah, I think broadly a little too set-up-y. Energy creature, not innately interesting, even if there's some interesting stuff going on around it. And a little disappointing that there was not a little bit more meat to Saru's story. So yeah, I'm gonna call it a polished and well-done episode that was still a weaker episode.
Yeah. It did feel a little filler-ish.
Yeah.
That's what you can do a lot if you're trying to set up the next big episode.
Yeah, to be fair, like if I kind of like the premise of you know, it seems like these the crystal aliens, the Pavoans, that they may be a little bit like the Organians, or this might even be an attempt to kind of like explore some of the untold, you know, like an Organian concept in a sort of more sophisticated way, that they if you were going to do an episode where they go to them and they're like, hey, can you help our effort? And they're like, oh, better yet, we'll put you together with your enemies and you can talk it out. And everybody's like, holy shit, what? That's an interesting idea. If you tried to do it all in one episode where they have to go down to this planet, have that happen, and then Cole and his crew arrive, you know, like two-thirds of the way in, you know, halfway in, even if you hurried it up, then the idea would probably feel a little bit cheap, you know, like just sort of throwaway. Here, I guess by using it, the setup, they kind of probably thought, we'll do that, we'll also use it as a way to explore something about Saru's character. I do get why they would split it into two episodes.
Yeah.
But yeah, unfortunately this one just, it didn't maybe have enough otherwise meat to it to kind of feel as strong as some of the past ones.
And that's kind of how I felt about the first two episodes.
You're talking about the prologue episodes?
Yeah, which were just set up for the show.
Yeah, but it's true. I am going to be kind of curious to when the whole season is done, to go back and kind of revisit those and to see what I think about the characters and motivations and what's percolating behind them, knowing a little bit more about all of them. I'll be curious to see how it all sort of holds up on a revisit post-season.
Mm. Well, and just as this episode sets up episode 9, I will now set up our audience for Star Trek, or I'm sorry, for Tex Trek Podcast 28 next week, where we will talk about, or wait, no, is this 28?
Yeah, this is like, 28.
So next one will be 29,
yep.
Where we will talk about Into the Woods I Go, I think is the name of the episode, or is it Into the Forest I Go? One of those two. Someone's going to, yeah, Into the Forest I Go.
Interesting.
The fall finale of Star Trek Discovery Season 1.
It'll be interesting to see what they do for a finale. This is a sort of another big test.
Maybe
moment.
They'll end the war. Maybe the Pavoans will have a successful little conference with Cole and Lorca, and you know, Cole and Lorca both seem like guys that could probably like reach an agreement and be peaceful.
You think this will end with maybe kind of like a they'll slowly reach out a hand and they'll shake hands and they'll smile just a little bit.
Yeah,
and they'll be like, you know what? I think we could be friends.
Yeah, then they'll go back into that room from last week's episode where they're having like the dance party, and like you have like Cole and Lorca, like one of them's got like their arm over the other one's shoulder, and they're just throwing back beers. And
that's probably what's going to happen.
Yeah, probably. So the show normally goes with that little type of
Yep. They do sometimes have their happier endings for darker shows, darker episodes. But yeah, this is definitely going to be an interesting sight to see, and then we'll shortly after that get into Star Trek novel stuff.
Yeah, and then sometime later this month, more than likely, we'll be talking about the novel Star Trek Discovery: Desperate Hours.
We'll find out about the threat known as the Juggernaut.
Yes, and the Burnham Saru sibling rivalry.
Yep.
So keep your eyes out for that. And
keep your ganglia up.
Your threat gangula. And don't leave that shit hanging. So until next time, live long and prosper, y'all. Thank all of you so much for checking out this installment of Tex Trek. I hope you enjoyed it. Please be sure to like our YouTube videos and subscribe to our channel. Audio-only version of episodes are available at our website, www.tex-trek.com. Please check out our site, especially if you just want an audio-only podcast. We have that available for you. Y'all can also keep up with us online. You can follow us on Twitter, at TXTrek, or you can check us out on Facebook at www.facebook.com/tex-trek. Please, by all means, let us know what you think by dropping a comment anywhere you see fit. We definitely want to hear your feedback. Let us know what you liked and what you would like to see more of, what you would like to see differently going forward. If you want to email me directly, go ahead. I can be reached at fatheryactual@tex-trek.com. Thank all y'all again. Take care.